On this edition of the program, we talked to Tom LoBianco about the fall of the pro-life movement in the Republican coalition and so much more. It's all coming up.
This is made possible by Blue Front and the Lenina. Owe Them Bones. Daily Tech News Show. V. And Craig.
Welcome, everybody, to the Politics program for May 1st, 2024. Your old pal, Justin Robert Young, joining you here in Austin, Texas. We'll be on with Tom here in a second, but I wanted to talk about this with you first. The success of your presentation will be judged not by the knowledge you send, but what the listener receives. That's author Lily Walters. Put crudely, if they don't want the product, doesn't matter how you sell it to them. I thought about this because Joe Biden is coming off what should be the final days of the official rechristening of his campaign machine, beginning with the State of the Union and ending with the White House Correspondents' Dinner. All very glitzy and powerful affairs. He's been doing presidential things whilst walking the presidential walk. The bully pulpit, his to frame the argument. The day he gave the State of the Union, a fiery performance held by partisans and media as a turning point, he trailed Trump by 1.7% in aggregate on the Real Clear Politics average. A run of good polling in March helped him close that 2.2 in mid-April. But as I record today, Trump's lead has again inflated to 1.4%. Now, obviously, that's horse race stuff, and we still are a very long way away from November. And we are going to talk more about Trump in our conversation a few minutes from now. But I'd like to focus on Biden here for a few minutes. For 3 months, the Biden team had a very clear runway to make their case as we go into the dog days of spring and early summer. And what is that case? Well, 4 points. Number one, the economy is good. Unemployment is low. Inflation is cooling. We pulled off the soft landing. Number two, the world is fragile, but thankfully the adults are in control. Number three, Donald Trump is an autocrat that will pass a national abortion ban, plunging America into theocratic darkness where women are second-class citizens. And number four, Donald Trump will also cancel democracy. The first two are treading water. Poll after poll shows that inflation and prices are still the top national concern for voters, and a hotter than expected inflation report last week has sent fresh panic into the idea that interest rates might not cool before November. Indeed, the S word, stagflation, has been mentioned. And of course, the world is a total mess. Money for Ukraine took a year to pry out of Congress. And today, our Secretary of State is abroad actively begging Hamas to take a ceasefire deal. All the while, Israel says that they are going to go into Rafah no matter what ceasefire arrangement they strike. The solution to both of those? Wait and pray. More actionable are the places where the Biden administration can take the offense. Abortion remains the X factor in this race. I believe that the Biden campaign is making a mistake by using dated verbiage like restore Roe, because it's something that people have heard quite a lot. It sounds a lot of samey, but that's something that we can return to on another show, and I'm sure we will. Let's head to that last point, though. Donald Trump will end democracy. This will be the last vote you ever cast if he wins. It's either Joe Biden or the gulag. Hyperbole aside, this is a plea to a base that would probably vote for Joe Biden anyway, in my opinion. If you're up to date on everything sources say Trump is set to do if elected, then you're probably already watching MSNBC. And you'd bank your vote for old Joe today if you could. For the rest of America, a lot of the supporting evidence for why Donald Trump is this boogeyman is just kind of old. We're talking about Trump one-liners and actions from 4 years ago. Back then, high school seniors were enduring Zoom proms and graduations. Now, those same kids are occupying administration buildings in Colombia in support of Palestine. My point is, life comes at you fast, and elections are about the future, not the past. Unfortunately for Biden, America is not as scared of Donald Trump as they were immediately after January 6th. They trust him on all of the top 10 issues that they say matter most in this election, more than Biden, save for two. The two that Biden scores better on: abortion and democracy. So maybe this strategy isn't limited because of a lack of imagination from the White House. It might be all they have to work with. This is your update brought to you by TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Come on over, support the program. This is the time to do it. Two bonus podcasts each and every week for the $3 club. Guys, thank you, thank you, thank you one more time. You know, I'm not going to do the full thing every single week, but I will for the next few weeks. Again, got a baby on the way. Wife is out of work. We're not stressing. Why? Because I have you. This is the biggest moneymaker for me. I am privileged to do it. And I very much work tirelessly every day to try to make it worth it for you. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Let's get into some of the stories we didn't have a chance to mention in this podcast. The House Freedom Caucus is openly upset with Speaker Mike Johnson, primarily due to his support for the bipartisan measure like Ukraine funding, FISA reauthorization, and the fiscal year 2024 spending packages. But despite the frustration, the caucus is not yet rallying behind Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's call to oust Johnson, opting instead for other forms of retaliation. The ongoing rift within the Republican ranks is complicated by the fact that there is no clear alternative to Johnson. Again, Mike Johnson is only the Speaker of the House because the last time they booted out the Speaker, they could only find one man who had less than five enemies. And it was that guy. So there we go. Potential candidates like House Majority Leader Steve Scalise and Majority Whip Tom Emmer obviously had more than five enemies the last time that they were on this merry-go-round. Johnson's position remains precarious, however, as he navigates significant challenges. His collaborative approach with Democrats, which, by the way, today, as I record this, Tuesday, had a memo go out, the Democratic caucus, saying that they would not only procedurally attempt to block a motion to vacate, but all but promised they would stand by Mike Johnson's side, saying maybe we've learned our lesson from the time that we ejected Kevin McCarthy. Very interesting. External pressures do continue. Johnson is endorsing a house-wide initiative to combat anti-Semitism on college campuses and faces calls to pass the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act before it expires. As this landscape evolves, Johnson's leadership will be tested by his ability. But, you know, look, if the Freedom Caucus, which has been the thorn in the side of both of the speakerships, well, I guess technically not this one, because Marjorie Taylor Greene is no longer a member of the House Freedom Caucus. She is a free radical when it comes to kicking up dust there in the People's Chamber. But the House Freedom Caucus would probably be the most likely to support stuff like that. They're not doing it. We move on. Let's head to the courtroom. Judge Juan Merchan says that Donald Trump will be fined $9,000 for violating prohibitions on commenting on witnesses. Prosecutors accused the former president of violating his gag order in his New York City hush money trial over multiple times, asking the judge to fine him $1,000 per violation. Under the gag order, Trump cannot make or direct others to make public statements about trial witnesses concerning their roles in the investigation. And at trial, prosecutors other than Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and members of the court staff or the district attorney's staff. Trump is free to criticize Mershon himself, though it probably will not help Trump win favor of the judge. Before the trial, Mershon extended the gag order to cover his family and Bragg's family after Trump posted about Mershon's daughter, who worked for a company that helped Democratic candidates with digital campaigns. Mershon did adjust the court schedule to permit Trump's attendance of his son Barron's high school graduation. We mentioned that a few weeks ago. Some suggested that it was calling his bluff. I don't think it's impossible. Although I do think he'd like to go see his high school graduation, right? I mean, I don't know how many of them before they get old. But also, it's going to be something that'll probably be covered by national media, so that'll be good for him. Mershon did mention, though, that $1,000 is not a lot of money for Donald Trump. And should he continue to flagrantly violate his gag order, well, he might have to put him in prison. Yipes. Stripes. That would probably affect public perception. And finally, Hunter Biden's legal team has issued a stern warning to Fox News, anticipating imminent defamation litigation. The legal notice, detailed in a letter obtained by Axios, demands that Fox News hosts like Sean Hannity and Jesse Waters preserve relevant documentation, potentially heralding a significant lawsuit. At the heart of the dispute is Fox News' unauthorized use of Hunter Biden's image and the dissemination of personal photographs in their program, The Trial of Hunter Biden, which scrutinizes his foreign business dealings. Biden's attorney, Tina Gladian, accuses the network of defaming Biden while profiting from his image, calling for the takedown of the mock trial series and the addition of editor's notes to related FoxNews.com articles. The looming lawsuit forms part of a broader strategy of Biden's legal team aiming to aggressively counter criminal charges and public misconceptions following his failed plea deal last summer. The approach has occasionally clashed with advice from White House advisors, but it is said he has the support of his father, President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. The legal battle unfolds as Hunter Biden prepares for upcoming trials in Delaware and California on gun and tax charges, respectively, with his lawyer, Abby Lowell, leading the defense on multiple fronts, except the Fox News case, because he's conflicted. There's zero chance that anybody in the Joe Biden 2024 campaign has blessed Hunter Biden going to war with the people who proverbially buy ink by the barrel. It is nearly impossible to win a defamation case when you are a public figure, and you do not get more of a public figure than the son of the president of the United States, especially one who has a very embarrassing laptop that was left at a computer store and then disseminated across the internet, where he did very colorful things like smoke crack and have threesomes with hookers that he uploaded to Pornhub. Hunter, buddy, come on. What are we doing here? What's happening? Who thought this was a good idea? This has got to be his lawyer friend that's footing his bills. The guy out in California that looks like he was an extra in The Big Lebowski. Like, if this election in any way centers around Hunter Biden, if Hunter Biden is mentioned more than abortion within the remaining months leading into this election, Joe Biden will lose. Now, Fox News is probably going to talk about whatever they wanted anyway, but they're certainly not going to lay off Hunter Biden now. I wouldn't think so. We'll have to wait and see. TakePoliticsSeriously.com, where you need to go if you want to get bonus episodes of this show. It's a good time. Our Sunday edition, we cover all of what is said on the Sunday shows, and then your late edition on Thursdays. video, and audio versions available. Head on over. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. With just over 150 days to the election, we bring back our friend Tom Lobianco of 24Sight. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Justin. Good to be back, man.
All right. So you wrote a book about Mike Pence. You spent a lot of time around the pro-life movement. And there is a story that I don't feel has been talked about a lot because either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party really want to bring attention to it. And that is that the pro-life movement, since Reagan, a staple of winning elections for Republican candidates, is sliding down the list of coalitional priorities to the point where the standard bearer of the party, Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee, came out and said, I'm not for federal legislation on abortion. This is something that would not have been said by any president or nominee ever in my lifetime. And yet now we are here. From your perspective, what is the role of the pro-life movement in the Republican Party?
It's fascinating to see, you know, as long as I've been covering politics for like 20, 25 years now, and as long as I've been writing about Republicans, I mean, there used to be a couple of benchmarks, you know, anti-abortion, you know, trying to overturn Roe v. Wade, which happened.
There we go.
2 years ago. I mean, that is a benchmark moment. Anti-taxes, cutting taxes. You know, I ran into Grover Norquist of last year at an event that Eric Erickson put it on. It was one of the Republican cattle calls, notably minus Donald Trump, but with everybody else. And I ran into him and we were talking about how strange it is that you don't have Republican candidates running on cutting taxes. I've never seen this in my lifetime. And, you know, as you've pointed out here, this is just inexorable shifting, juggling, sorting of what the Republican Party is. What are the baselines now? If you go back to, and I wrote about this in the book, and it really helped me understand, you know, why Pence was ascendant and, you know, looking back on it now, why he doesn't play anymore inside this Republican Party. When back in the 70s, you know, of course, Roe v. Wade is 1973, and you have this, you know, instantaneous backlash among conservatives. And what you had was a number of conservative activists drove down from Washington to Lynchburg, Virginia, to meet with a man named Morton Blackwell. Morton Blackwell, he might still be a member of the Republican National Committee. He was with that crowd of Goldwater conservatives back in the 60s, Buckley, you think about R. Emmett Tyrell, founder of the American Spectator, folks that created YAF, the Young Americas Foundation. All these things which became staples. I mean, you know, Blackwell back then created CPAC, the American Conservative Union. And it was designed originally before it was the Hungarian conservative movement, you know, which we have now. It was the it was about bringing college students to meet with conservative power players and recruit them into the movement. And so in the 70s, they started this thing called the From the Pews, Empty the Pews of the Churches, because they knew that in religious, in the, you know, amongst the Southern Baptist in particular, the Christian, what would become to be known as the Christian right, that there was this deep well of opposition to Roe v. Wade, to, you know, federal rights for abortion access. And the question was, how do they activate them? And they said, so they created the pro-life movement. You know, you had the Right to Life March in D.C. I mean, I laugh when I hear, you know, Trump try to walk away from abortion, because he was the first ever president of the United States to address the Right to Life March. And, you know, Pence came up in this movement, When they selected Pence for the ticket in 2016, it was because they needed those voters. This is kind of, the political corollary here in a mechanical sense would be black voters for Democrats. You know, I think Colin Jost had a pretty good line at the White House dinner this past weekend about, this is, being more popular than trying to get, Biden trying to get black voters to show up in November. And the concern with Pence, which is why they picked him in 2016, and this is the dynamic that we're looking at now, is mm-hmm. that potentially it's not that they vote for Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or, RFK Jr. It's that they stay home.
That they don't come out. Yeah.
Yes. And so what you have is, we're coming up on the second year anniversary of Dobbs, which is remarkable to me.
Time flies,
right? If you look at there's always been kind of a split on the Christian right, and this is true of any political movement. You have people that are more transactional. You have people that are more just in it for the power, and you have the ideologues, people who are like, yes, we really want an end to abortion. This is life.
Yeah,
you must protect all life. Immediately afterwards, I remember Marjorie Dannenfelser, the longtime president of the Susan B. Anthony List, was one of the big anti-abortion groups. She commented, it's like the dog that caught the car.
I totally agree. In fact, I've used that analogy quite a bit. But I wonder, and I think the larger question is, of course, how long does the Republican side electorally pay for the fact that they now the crystal cracked and they don't have the one thing they can all agree on anymore? The optimistic side of it from their perspective would be it was 22. We got caught with our pants down. We didn't have a strategy for what was going to happen. We didn't have a consistent message. We didn't have the candidates that would be able to carry the message if we did have a message. We paid for it. We should have done better. We didn't do as good as we wanted. We still got the house, although that turned into as much of a curse as it was a blessing. But still, that was where they paid for it. Whereas now you have to wonder exactly, obviously it's their biggest liability. It is right now, if you look at the top 10 issues, the one exhaust port on the Death Star, otherwise they are doing very, very good. In terms of what people care about, but we don't have a pro-life movement in my mind anymore. Like we had an anti Roe versus Wade movement. That was a coalition that was pretty wide. You could get high-minded conservatives. You could get the suburbs. You can get the ideologues in the pews. But now the question is after, really it's the Reagan coalition that folds them in. We're now many years of data tracking. We're many times generations of people of just being lock stock members of the Republican Party. You can get these guys out in ways that was harder to do and more expensive to do in the late 70s in 2024. So the question really is, okay, is it a big turnout, opportunity for the Republicans now as it would have been back then?
Do you need it? Some of this, I think is when we look at this polling, if you look at the Gallup and Pew, the way that the folks identify what is quote unquote an evangelical
important voter to them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. 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 Evangelical.
What is evangelical? And I mean that itself is as amorphous a definition of just saying it's a, we have Latino voters, and it's like, well,
yes.
Okay. I think people from Venezuela, Venezuelan refugees living in South Florida are going to vote a lot differently than Tejanos. Okay. It's just very different. And some of that, is on us as journalists to parse that a little bit better. I mean, you can get, we live here at that 30,000 foot level, among evangelicals, and just as a practice, it's a huge pool. But that subset, the Christian right, has changed a lot in 8 years. I remember when Pence was campaigning last year, it was actually, I think it was kind of his pre-campaign stage. That guy in his career is a master of the pre-campaign. Remember back in
the- Oh, yeah. He was basically doing the circuit of successful candidates that Trump didn't like.
Yes.
Like I saw him speak with Brian Kemp. He was doing all of these, you know, they were winner candidates that he could stand next to. Yes. And he's a good campaigner. That's the thing. Yes, Pence gets a rap of being a boring dude, which I think is largely painted by the fact that he had to stand behind Donald Trump and knew that the role of the vice president was to neither be seen nor heard. But, but when he's out there on the stump, you remember he was a radio guy. Like he's a natural talker.
He would talk about, in an academic sense, this is Marxism, small M Marxism. He would talk about how politics is downstream of culture, right? Technology changes, then social structure, and then superstructure. And politics is somewhere in that range between superstructure and social structure. Maybe not religion, although sometimes it is. And he was talking about how the Republicans and especially the conservatives, and I'm going to say capital C conservatives, people who identify within that movement, need to adjust to these social changes. And you can almost hear him talking about himself, because here's somebody who came up in the pro-life movement, had incredible success. He could, in his career, he could vacillate on things of trade. I remember in the 2000 run for office, he said that NAFTA was the only thing he agreed with Bill Clinton on. And then 16 years later, he's in the White House renegotiating NAFTA for, the other way from a Republican. I mean, if you told me a Republican would be the person tamping down the free trade agreement versus this old Southern Democrat.
I mean, that ranks up there with like a Republican being the one to go after Disney in Florida. It's like it was just a thing that I never thought as a Floridian was ever possible. It was definitely going to be an anti-corporate Democrat that would have done it.
I wrote about this for The Messenger last summer, and I got a lot of pushback from a number of Trump folks for this. But it bore out. There was some really good polling about what we're talking about here, which is what is the current Republican coalition? What is the right center, right? What does that make up right now? And, Nate Cohen, the lead analyst in the New York Times, has done a very good piece about what are the different factions of the party. And for Donald Trump in particular, he has this a group of, it's about like 40%. Like when we think about, we used to talk about like that hardcore MAGA that was enough to carry him all the way through the primaries. He coined it as the hard right talkers, people that love Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, predominantly Southern, very culturally conservative. But then this new group of Rust Belt populist blue collar workers from the North, not really the Northeast. We tend to think of that more of like Rockefeller types like Susan Collins, but, union members. Everybody that helped swing the election, really back and forth in Michigan, Wisconsin, where we're still battling. And the singular dividing line between those two groups, and we saw that play out in the Ohio ballot measure last year. Literally as a microcosm of this, is abortion. For the Southern cultural hardcore conservatives, that's a benchmark issue. And in Ohio, one of the reasons that this effort to ban abortion, via the Constitution, the state Constitution, lost there was because you lost the Republican voters up in the Northeast. Akron, Youngstown, all the places that we started paying a lot more attention to after 2016 because they went Trumpy. They're still Trumpy. They just don't support abortion. And to this bigger question now of, okay, well, what does the pro-life movement do? It's like we're watching like a focus group. This is like a Frank Luntz dial test in real time.
Yes.
And, you know, stretched over the course of 2 years. And the dial, like, you know, they keep on spinning it one way or the other. It's okay. Leave it to the states. All right. Well, again, there you go. All right. Maybe a national abortion ban. Is it 15 weeks? Is it 6 weeks? Trump himself doesn't want to talk about this because it's a loser for him.
Yeah.
And he is the Republican Party. That's, you know, that is set. It's not everybody. And there's still a large contingent of Nikki Haley folks out there. But they're still struggling with how to talk about this. You know, is it these the pregnancy crisis centers, which are, you know, it's like it's branded as like a, you know, a Planned Parenthood, you know, family planning center type thing. But it's about making sure that the, you know, the mothers carry the baby to term. And then moving from there. Is it that? Is it we don't want to touch it anymore? States, you can deal with it. That doesn't even work. Arizona, the 1864 law was going to go into effect. And enough Republicans down there are like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like,
how about we don't do that? How about, And look, if the Arizona Republican Party can pull their head out of their butt for, you know, 11 seconds enough to realize, hey, a pre-statehood law banning abortion is not going to be great for us in November, then you understand this is a gigantic klaxon flashing light. And it brings us to kind of one of the other biggest themes that we've seen in this election so far. And that is the Trump campaign's competence. Like they are treating this the way that you would expect a competent campaign to treat it, which is understand how they're being attacked.
Yes.
Do their best to mitigate it.
Yes.
And then don't talk about it.
Oh,
don't make this, don't make this an issue. Every moment that we talk about it, any moment that it hits the front page and the border doesn't, and the economy doesn't, we're losing.
Yes.
So, he came out and after Biden ran ads, Trump wants a federal abortion ban, came out, said, I do not want a federal abortion ban. Everybody on the pro-life can scream and yell at me. I'll take the earful. It's all up to the states. That's my policy. Congratulations, California. You get your law. We'll deal with everything else as it comes along. But, you know, I don't know what else they could do. Because you're right. There is no consensus on the pro-life side right now. When we watched the primaries, and I think this is probably the most educational thing that we got from those debates, was we had three candidates that came up and said that they wanted a federal abortion ban. And it was Tim Scott, Asa Hutchinson, and Mike Pence. And they were all gone within 2 weeks.
Yes.
And that's before Iowa. Not one of them could consolidate in Iowa.
Yeah.
That the place where evangelicals roam.
Yes.
Like, so that's that to me said everything that you needed to say about the modern coalition. It doesn't exist. Yes. There are hardcores for whom it will always be a major issue. And right now the Republican Party is saying, fight amongst your state.
Yes.
Go do that there. That we now have a coalition that you're right. I was literally in Central Ohio this weekend visiting my wife's family. It's a Trumpy place.
Yes.
And they do not care about abortion in the same way that they do in the South.
Yes.
They just don't.
Yes. It's number one. Well, while I'm thinking about this, I would recommend everybody listening, go check out Michael Cruz at Politico. He wrote, I think, it might be the best profile I've read this cycle. And it's not getting a lot of attention, or at least not yet, because of this dynamic. He wrote an amazing profile of Susie Wiles. And
yes. You know, oh my God. Yeah. Yes. I read that. That was, I mean, a lot of access for Susie Wiles, somebody who does not talk a lot.
Yes. You know, as a man of Florida, Susie is, it's that old 90-10 rule of power in politics. 90% of the people doing, 90% of the talking with only 10% of the access to power, while the actual 10% with power don't say a thing. And Susie's for decades has been that the power that doesn't talk. I love that detail that he had in there about how she's swishing her Splenda in her drink at a Starbucks. And it's like, you know, normally when we write these type of things, you know, you think about like Theodore White, you know, the making of the president,
yep.
You know, you think about like, oh, meeting at the Hay Adams in downtown Washington across the street from the White House. And, you know, like, a fine china, you know, a neatly poured espresso. Susie Wiles is one of the most powerful people in politics right now. And you'd never know it just walking down the street down Palm Beach. You know, you'd see her with sunglasses on in the little Starbucks. And there's some reporter from Politico. It was a great piece and so, so important. They have done, I mean, consider this for a second. You have a Republican nominee who is joking about maybe he'll be a dictator. Maybe he won't. I'm only going to be a dictator on certain things. You know, using language that, you know, the Nazis used in the 30s about poisoning the blood of the country. That's Nazi language, you know, whether he's cognizant of it or not, people have told him that and he doesn't take it back. The language itself is as extreme as it could possibly be. But the campaign, the operation is as staid as it could possibly be. And that's Susie. She is a maestro at this.
Well, but also it's like, who thought it was possible, right? That's the biggest thing is that, yeah. Because now if we look back at it and we say, okay, well, was everybody else incompetent? Was everybody else just not able to do it? Is it somewhere between, okay, get him off Twitter. Twitter kind of decreases mm-hmm. in its importance. Now he has his own place where he can just kind of say whatever he wants. And half the time people care about it, but most of the time people don't. And other than that, they've spent a remarkable amount of time actually pissing outside the tent. That did not happen in 2016. Yes. It didn't happen in 2020. Yes. Now, COVID factors into that a little bit because there was a lot of controversy over lockdowns and everything. But, you know, aside from the primaries folding, he hasn't really taken a whole lot of shots about, you know, Nikki Haley. I mean, he's sideswiped Lindsey Graham. But if you're not running, or if you're not yelling at Lindsey Graham, are you really even in politics?
Or when Lindsey Graham smashed his cell phone and
because he gave out his number on Twitter or at a campaign event, just read Lindsey Graham's phone number. Oh, that 2016 primary. What a hoot.
Trump hasn't changed. Trump himself has not changed.
No.
But, you know, if you read Maggie Haberman's book, it's amazing. The way that he came up. I mean, and remember, this is the P.T. Barnum aspect of all mm-hmm. this. You know, he might be crazy, but he's crazy like a fox in terms of operations. You know, like, remember that when he was coming up in real estate in New York in the 80s, one of the things that he did was tactically demolished his opposition in the city council, working the political levers of the mm-hmm. New York, the Democratic machine in particular. Until he became a powerful developer in Manhattan, which did not, you know, his father had not yet achieved at that point.
Yeah.
He took the family forward in that way. That took a decade. That took from the late 70s, early 80s, up into the late 80s before, I believe, his first bankruptcy, post Art of the Deal. And then I think he did the Art of the Comeback after that. He did the same thing in politics.
Yeah.
He came into the Republican Party as an aggressive outside force and systematically dismantled the opposition piece by piece. And, you know, I would argue that the final clear marker of that was removing a member of the Romney family from the head of the Republican Party, Ronna McDaniel.
That he installed.
yes, exactly. Installed her in 2016 when he needed that support, when he needed donors, when he needed everybody that used to be on the Jeb Bush Super PAC Rolodex.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that if you were a Republican donor who thought it was unseemly that somebody tried to overturn an election that they lost, And had, you know, a paramilitary storming the White House, you know, smashing cops in the heads with, you know, the fire extinguishers and, you know, the flagpoles and you name it, and literally smearing crap on the walls of the Capitol. I can't even believe I'm saying this out loud. It's like, it's still surreal. You could give money. If you're one of those donors who said, I'm never giving to Donald Trump again, the workaround was you could give money to the Republican Party and you could still support other Republican candidates. And, you know, 3 years later, Trump removes her. He's like, all right, you did what I needed you to do. You're gone. Now, one of my campaign managers, Chris LaCivita, and the daughter-in-law of Laura Trump, one of the daughter-in-laws, are in there running the show.
With Michael Whatley from North Carolina.
Yes, technically the chairman.
It's you don't think he's calling the shots?
Not from what I hear.
Yeah.
And some of that's normal. I mean, some of that's normal.
Well, I mean, I do think that in general, it's not odd for a nominee to replace somebody at the party with somebody that they trust. And, you know, the Rana thing to me is she had also had a lot of people in, you know, infighting amongst, you know, she had very loud constituencies that hated her and thought that she was wasting a lot of money, that she was too close to donors and she was giving too favorable, you know, it's like, oh, okay, well, we're going to make these decisions based on who's serving the cake at the party. And, you know, that was a problem. Well, here, let me pivot real quick because you're working on something now about a moment that this year became crystal clear to you.
Yes.
What did you see? What vision has appeared in the mind of Mr. Lobion?
So, you know, we call it 20 foresight because we have that psychic ability to peer into
the premonitions.
Yes. our Palantir over here. It's a you know, endless seltzer.
There we go.
As my colleague, Warren Rojas, and I were on the White House party, House Correspondents' Dinner circuit over the last 5 days. And, I think one of the defining characteristics heading into last week was how chaotic things have been in politics. It's you know, very much everything, everywhere, all at once. I was watching Rick and Morty season one, Rixty Minutes last night. and this is what I do to decompress. And some people, some people read Robert Caro. You know, and there's that one sketch they have with it's just, you know, it's all improvised. It's like the two brothers movie where they have the Mexican Armada, you know, tomatoes with guns and like wild cats. And and it's hilarious because it's, you know, it's it is in adding the my power's going out here. Okay, we're good. Backup generator is on. We're cool. They just keep throwing more things in there little by little by little. And, you know, you can see, I think it's Dan Harmon does, you're used to do all the voices.
Or was it, Justin Roiland getting blackout drunk and improvising, which back at the time was a lot cuter than it is right now.
Yes. Yeah, seriously. Yeah. And it just keeps on throwing more things. And it's like they add in, like, you know, it's like, oh, and a, you know, a comet is landing on the Earth. And he's like, and you can see like the characters are like, oh, Jesus, really? It's like, and it's like, da 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 da, the movie. Well, that was the 2024 election heading into this.
Yes.
It's, you know, okay, we have, you know, something which could potentially turn into World War III, probably will not, thank God, but Israel.
You never know.
War. Right. It's, you know, we have the multiple criminal trials of a former president of the United States. We have, you name it, just week after week after week, new things being thrown in there. And what I noticed, and, you know, Warren and I were talking a little bit about this, is that, you know, you started last week with Donald Trump on trial, the tabloid trial, David Pecker, the former head of the National Enquirer, mm-hmm. testifying about, you know, hiding stories.
Catch about, and kill.
Yeah. And yeah, in any normal circumstance, a former president being on trial for this would be a singular issue. And as you rolled through the week, you know, we had the Supreme Court take up the question of is a president out of office?
Yeah.
Completely immune from any action. Remember listening to the oral arguments there, and Elena Kagan, mm-hmm. Justice Elena Kagan was asking, it's like, well, you know, hypothetically, if a president directs a military coup and it doesn't work, you know, can they be prosecuted for that once they're out of office? You know, just talking hypotheticals here. Like,
yeah.
And it was surreal. But by the end of this, and, you know, we're going to have this over at 24site.news. For our White House weekend wrap. At the end of this, you had Joe Biden and Colin Jost, Saturday Night Live, there talking about the seriousness of what this election is. And you've seen so many things gelling. We had they set up. It used to be that you could actually go into the Washington Hilton. You used to be able to actually go to the hotel bar there and post up and hang out and interview people, celebrities and like quasi celebrities and whatnot. You didn't actually need a ticket to go to the dinner. You had hundreds and hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters descend on the Hilton. On Saturday. So they sent up a 2-block security perimeter and they weren't letting people in. You had last week between the trial, between the Supreme Court, between Biden addressing the seriousness of this moment, you know, which is like, okay, we can all laugh about this, but this election is huge. Like I remember I was talking with, I was interviewing. I was actually shooting the red carpet at one of the Hollywood events they had downtown, the Creator Coalition. And Lauren Ash, who does my Chicago party aunt, she does like a lot of the voices. My kid used to watch the reboot of She-Ra, and I was looking her up. She's like the voice of Scorpia on She-Ra. So tell her I met somebody famous.
Hey,
she'll actually know, as opposed to, you know, all the politicians we cover. And she was talking about how this is so hugely important, and it's surreal to even be talking about this. You know, what might happen, you know, after November. And she says, I hope people, you know, can read between the lines of this, and because it's like surreal to be talking about. And you don't have to read between the lines, because it's, you know, we are now we're at the end of April, heading into May. You see this in the polling, you see the race tightening. You see RFK Jr., who is still a formidable force and, you know, getting the ballot access, who will be a determinative factor. All the variables have been falling away. The wild cards out there, you know, I think back to the heady days of August 2023 when Vivek Ramaswamy was rapping Eminem. And, you know, that looked like that might be a thing. You know, Tim Scott has a girlfriend. Nobody's seen her. Now they're engaged.
Yep.
You know, things are like falling into place. Kristi Noem talked about shooting a dog.
Book on purpose, which is apparently a book without an editor. Fire the editor. Right? The fact that somebody didn't say, hey, can we just say livestock? Yeah. Do we have to say 9-month-old puppy?
Is this the anecdote necessary? You want? Like, what are we demonstrating here? As we draw into the thick of the election, I think, you know, especially a lot of the country has been tuned out on politics. You know, again, to that the Rick and Morty comparison here, because it's just so extreme for so long that it becomes exhausting. But people are reengaging now, and you're starting to see a coalescing, a crystallizing of the field. What are the issues? As we were talking about earlier, abortion. Republicans don't want to talk about that. What do Republicans want to talk about? Immigration. Immigration is a unifier on the right now. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see
48% of Democrats in a poll last week are for mass deportations.
Yeah.
That is a number that I didn't ever think I would see in my life.
Yes. Yes. We're starting to see what will be the defining issues of this election. When, you know, when we all go back and, you know, write our recaps, you know, in December and January, when the campaign books start coming out, these will be the singular issues. And it felt to me like, you know, being out at a number of these parties, that we know what they are now. We know where to focus. There's less distraction. So I'll give you an example. You know, part of our ethos at 24Sight is we don't focus on Marjorie Taylor Greene.
No.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is built for internet clicks. That's for a business model that's built around having virality. All right.
And yeah.
I would argue virality on the internet as a business model. MTG, white balloons, you know, talking about Jewish space lasers, you know, heating up your bagel sandwich in the morning or whatever the hell she talks about, has been overtaken by this AI making pictures of like kids on like onion bikes or whatever the hell it was. A shrimp.
African kid who made a project that gets 50,000 Facebook likes because your grandma can't tell it's an AI image.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
She's like, okay, if you vote on Ukraine aid and if you give more money to Ukraine, I'm getting rid of you, Mike Johnson.
I agree. I think that, and also it's like the fact that she's probably going to wind up dropping it because Trump wants her to drop it just shows you exactly the limits for which she really, you know, buys into this. But let me go back to the idea of crystallizing what these issues are, because I have found the Biden campaign to be particularly frustrating in their inability to define things in a way that really helps them. I've you know, their number one issue is abortion. And the fact that they are running on Restore Roe, it just sounds like Roe is on. It literally sounds like every Democratic candidate over my entire lifetime, including Joe Biden multiple times running for president, I think is a huge mistake. You need to make this a unique thing. This is different. This is not the same as it was before. We are not going to restore Roe. We are going to chart a new course. We're in a world that is not like the world before because of the chaos man that made the chaos. But what I worry from their perspective is, especially in these very comfortable events like the White House Correspondents' Dinner, is everyone's going to solemnly nod and say, yes, yes, now we understand Donald Trump is closer than ever to the White House. And eventually everybody's going to wake up and eventually everybody's going to say, boy, this isn't for us. And we can't have January 6th part two or whatever. But here's the reality. Top 10 issues that people care about right now by almost every polling is 9-1 of things that Donald Trump is not only leading in, but has been talking about in shocking message discipline for the last year.
Yes.
And we talked about this a week ago. Donald Trump opened up his biggest lead in not only against his primary opponents, but also against Joe Biden when he got indicted.
Yes.
There is a real theory of when we write these recaps, one of the things that I'm tracking is there a lawfare backlash? Is Donald Trump, if Donald Trump has played this the way that he has done it and he has been the martyr, and I think that he's done it smartly, saying, I can't go to my son's graduation. I can't go to the Supreme Court thing. However silly that stuff is, it's highlighting one thing. I am being railroaded.
Yes.
This is unfair. And yes, especially with the New York case, yes, where try to explain that charge to somebody who doesn't follow politics in two sentences. it is a challenge. Like, that's been effective. And you know, we'll see where the polls go, but you had a CNN poll that had in the five wide him up 9, head to head him up 6. Mm-hmm. That's a poll that has increased for him going forward. I don't know. I wonder if there is an urgency or a creativity for the Biden campaign that they're going to need, because right now they're fighting from underneath. And unless the economy dramatically takes a better stance, and, you know, we just got, you know, the dreaded S word, stagflation, really kind of picking up again last week.
Totally.
Like, look, talk to Jimmy Carter while he's still alive. That ain't good.
Yes.
That's the kind of stuff that makes you a one-termer.
It's a couple things here. Number one, I think that I don't think that this this court case, the Stormy Daniels case, which is the first ever criminal trial of a former president of the United States, that's history.
You know,
it might only be one sentence in the history books because of how much other history we have occurring all at once, but it is history.
It is.
And I don't think it helps Trump. I was talking with sources about this at various events. Remember what this is born out of. It's born out of Trump not wanting to talk about this, because way back in 2016, after the Access Hollywood tape, where he talks about how he can just, you know, quote unquote, grab women by the pussy after he pops a Tic Tac. You know, this was designed to stop a story about an affair from making it into the election. So, you know, define irony. 8 years later, that story is at the heart of the election.
But it's also, I mean, talk about reruns. How much do we have to talk? We've talked about this for so long. I think it might have first popped before that Rick and Morty episode that you yes, talked about.
Yes, that's like, right.
It did. I mean, this is... We're so long into this. Michael Cohen's switched sides. Michael Avenatti has switched sides. Right. All the Michaels are switching sides. Like, we've Stormy Daniels wrote a book. She's declared bankruptcy. Like, we've just been. I don't think that there's anything new under the sun with David Pecker or Michael Cohen or Michael Avenatti or Stormy Daniels. Whatever there is about Donald Trump and that fateful afternoon or evening in the Lake Tahoe Shark golf Week. Course.
Yeah.
Exactly. The Lake Tahoe golf course. I think we know. Everybody has priced that in.
But what it's done is Trump is like disco. It was wild for like 4 years. And then one day everybody woke up and they acted like it never happened. And this is disco. This is reliving 2016 day in and day out. And if you want, it's for a number of reasons, you know, you could argue about the legal, you know, viability here and even whether any of this should be prosecuted. It's created for the next 6 weeks as we head into the thick of the general election, a constant reminder in the press of, you know, these people. I haven't thought about Michael Avenatti since he went to jail for bilking Stormy Daniels. And now he's back. You know, it's like a punchline. It's like a Scaramucci, you know, the British prime minister lasts, you know, as long as a wilted head of lettuce, which turns out to be, it was like 10 Scaramuccis or something like that. Who knows? Like,
yes.
And it's a reminder to the general public that doesn't like pay attention to this stuff religiously like we do, that like, wow, that was wild when it happened, but it was also a decade ago. And, you know, we've all kind of moved on since then, or at least we're trying to move on.
Yeah, I'm going to take the opposite side in that. I do think that it is a beneficial if his narrative is whatever is happening here is useless. and you're probably bored by it because you've heard it a million times. The only thing that you need to focus on is that every day you see me walking in and out of a courtroom saying, I can't do X, Y, or Z. I would love to be in Pennsylvania. I'd love to be in Georgia. I'd love to be in Nevada. I'm being kept here because Joe Biden's prosecutors are trying to make this not a fair fight because they don't believe that they can win a fair fight. Well, that's something that if that's the issue, and right now that's a more fresh issue than anything to do with the facts of this case.
Mm-hmm. It works in his universe, and you know, with the bifurcation of media, the rise of conservative media as its own universe. It works in that world. But again, remember, you know, the indictment when it happened, you know, a year ago, the first ever indictment of a former president, it solidified his base. But you don't win elections on bases.
But it also opened him up with it opened up the first lead that he had with independents on Biden. And that's the big thing. It's like,
Yes, it
solidified the base and you only win it there. But the first time that he started to really open up a real lead against Biden, except for 1 month, according to the Real Clear Politics Average, was after these indictments. And the more he got indicted, the more independents took a second look at
it. Yes. Okay. So look at last Tuesday. There was a Republican primary. There are still Republican primaries in Pennsylvania. Yep. Nikki Haley, who is not running and has, you know, actively stayed out of the spotlight. I think she's at the Hudson Institute now. I mean, that is like the definition of not being in the spotlight.
In the basement. Yeah.
Yes. Pulled 17% of the vote in there. No active campaigning. And it was in the suburbs of Philadelphia, moderate women. All of the jockeying of the would-be VP candidates has been, a lot of it has been around trying to win over suburban women. I mean, it's the same thing, you know, and again, this is why they brought out Juanita Broderick to the Democratic debate, all the Clinton, you know.
This was in 2016 after Access Hollywood.
Yep. To rebut that, this has been the long running weak point for Trump in his coalition, in trying to win office. It wasn't an issue in 2016. I mean, but it became an issue as that the novelty started to wear off, and it's still a deep concern among the Trump folks. So I don't see how. I mean, in an academic sense, in a repertorial sense. You know, to me at least, the cases that really deeply matter are around January 6th and the removal.
Yeah, and that one's not going to get heard.
Exactly. Right.
I mean, that's my point. I totally agree with you. I think the Dox case hurts him. It's not going to get to a decision by the time that the election rolls around. And it doesn't look like the January 6th case might even happen by the time that. We might never see it because the Supreme Court is now going to decide what public and private, blah, 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 blah. Oh, time off the clock. I think it would be an outside shot that it even begins. And so if the only trial that gets to a decision is Alvin Bragg's case, which is, I think, legally speaking, by far the weakest and by far the oldest, then that's a net positive for Donald Trump. Now, the Georgia one, because of the circus that happened around Fannie Willis, who knows exactly where that lands in terms of public perception, but it's going to be hard to not look at that. It's going to be easy, rather, for the Trump campaign to paint this as malicious in the way that they're going to be able to, and they've effectively been able to paint Alvin Bragg as malicious. If that's it, then I do think that lawfare is something that they are going to be able to build on top of. Now, who it speaks to, that gets back to our coalition argument. The Nikki Haley point, all I would say is this. I think that, yes, that is a number that you don't want to see if you're the Trump campaign, obviously.
Yes. Yes.
But is a Nikki Haley voter more likely to fall into one of three buckets? Voting, eventually settling for Trump because they still want to vote in a Republican presidential election. Normally we would say, okay, well, somebody, if they're upset, yes, there's hardcore Bernie fans. Eventually they're going to, you know, come into the tent, blah, blah, blah. Are they not going to vote, or are they going to vote for Biden? And I don't think anybody who has a strong opinion on where they're going to land is doing anything but guessing.
Yes, it's hard to tell, but I keep coming back to maybe they don't show up.
I think they might.
People staying home, I think, is the bigger X factor here. And which groups, you know, for Biden and the Democrats, it's do minority voters show up? Do blacks and Latino mm-hmm. voters show up? For Republicans, it's do women and hardcore social conservatives show up? I don't know. I don't know how demoralizing this
which is the only correct. That's the only correct answer. The only correct answer is that we don't know. And we respect you, the audience, to not make a big thing about it. We got to get you out of here. Tom LoBianco, 24 site. Where can people go find it? It is great, great work.
Thank you, Justin. Yep. 24 site is number 24sight.news. Find us over on Substack. Love working with Substack. 24sight.news. We are getting platformed. Oh, we'll have a new logo up pretty soon as we start to go live. We're adding video. And Justin, looking forward to having you on our video podcast as we take it from audio to the full kit and caboodle.
There we go. The only way to live. Well, I very much look forward to being on.
Awesome. Justin, thanks so much, bro.
Absolutely. Thank you. Tom LoBianco. And that will wrap it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio here in Austin, Texas. You want to send me an email? Anything that Tom brought up you want to discuss further? Send your boy a note. TheYoungAmerican@gmail.com. Of course, you can find, follow, and share video clips of this show. TikTok is Justin R. Young. Instagram is Justin R. Young. Politics, Politics, Politics is our YouTube. Full episodes, by the way, on YouTube. Subscribe to the YouTube. Full video. For everything that we do. We're a dual threat podcast these days. Twitter is Justin R. Young, and you can share the audio version of this podcast at px3podcast.com. Support me with a one-time donation, paypal.me/payjury. Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Cash App is PX3 Cash. And checks and anything else you'd like to send in the mail. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Of course, you can always get our bonus content at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week each and every week, covering all the news that we miss on our free podcasting schedule. You get that and your name read at the end of the show if you are at the $10 tier. A gang of folks we like to call the Titanic $10 tier. Including Sugar Brady, Sam, John, Niemeister, Edwin, and Vogloria Young for King of the New World Order, Brian, Edison, Jeremy, a dog named Checker, Sarah Jeannie, Matthew, Dr. G, Shad, Dustin, Brad, D Laser, Nick, just another pilot, middle aged Mike, Utah, Jimmy, Montana, the Gen, Alo, D, really, Andrew, Lisa, Fat Tony's PJs from New York, Devon, the CFP, Gloria, Gray Zone, Peepaw, J, Neil, John, DP4, Bongo, Neil, is Nerdiness, Charles, Audrey, Stoll, Adler, Spot, Darren, Idris, Arslanian, Berkeley, Steven, Nomadic, Terran, Molly's Delightful Demeanor, Adam, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, and you. If you head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That'll be it for us today, though. Thank you for joining us. We will be back on Friday on the main feed because we're going to be talking about the economy and the AI economy specifically. Good friend of mine, great thinker, wrote what I think is a great dividing line in the sand article in Reason Magazine. It is titled the following. In the AI economy, there will be 0% unemployment. I would encourage you guys to read it before you listen to the show on Friday. But if you don't, you're going to get a summation of it then. Essentially, if you've ever had questions of why is AI so hyped, how will it affect society, and how will it affect the politics around that technology? Well, phenomenal conversation. You're going to love it on Friday. Till then, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics, but this is the only one that dares discuss. Oh, three.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.